This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When I look back on Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, it seems like eons ago. The film of that speech is grainy, black and white. The audio, tinny. But I also remember living through those days and watching that speech as it happened. For me and millions of others my age and older, it is a living memory. We connect it to all the turmoil of the civil rights era and what came afterward. We remember life before and after the accomplishments of the movement. But for young people, that time, those words, that film can look as ancient as Matthew Brady's photographs of the Civil War and seem as long ago as the American Revolution. How can we keep such a momentous nation-changing time alive and relevant to 21st century students? How do we frame that era in the history books, even as the events of that time fade into the mists of history? That task has fallen to someone who knows that time and the players well. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author best known for his trilogy of books chronicling the life of Dr. King and the history of the civil rights movement. His most recent work distills his trilogy into a smaller volume meant to be used by history teachers and general readers to pass on the stories of the time. The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement is the name of the book, and Taylor Branch returns to the program to talk about it, about history, and about that tumultuous period of American history. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to be back with you. Nice to be back in North Carolina for a UNC grad.
Oh, God, I didn't know that. How come I didn't know that about you?
Yes.
Your trilogy of books on Dr. King and America in the King Years is regarded as a masterpiece, and we talked about this trilogy when you were on the program before. It's enormous. Why isn't that enough? for those interested in Dr. King and the years of the Civil Rights Movement, why take such a detailed examination of the period and then distill it down?
Well, those books aren't going anywhere, I hope. I am blessed as an author that, you know, most books disappear after 6 months or less, and those books are still in print 25 years later. But I do get complaints from people who say that their collarbones have taken a beating because they're so heavy or that they can't take them on a plane. But more than that, for me, I got complaints from history teachers, both in college and in high school, saying that while they like the storytelling approach to the King Years that I use, that it's impractical to assign an 800-page book in today's college courses in the digital age, and that it would be good they thought it would be good to try to do something that made it more accessible, more compact, to introduce the key lessons and the key moments from that era to a new generation of readers. So that's the part of the genesis for this is for teachers. I love history teachers, and they're really beleaguered in this day and age because we measure our schools by the way they perform in teaching math and reading tests, not history. And since history is kind of on the low end of the totem pole, it doesn't get much allocation for books. And a good history teacher is going to be pressured to teach English. They need all the help they can get. And I wanted to give them material that would be accessible for their students because I think studying American history is unique because it's a key to citizenship. We have to understand how citizenship works in our world.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. We've talked about how we're teaching to tests, and the tests are geared at reading and math skills, and somehow social studies and history have fallen by the wayside, or certainly taken a deep back seat to all of this. And it seems to me, and I've said this, and you just said it, that to be a good citizen, you have to know history, don't you?
That's certainly what I think, and of course I also think that the civil rights era, we're coming up on 50 years. We're going to be going through all these 50-year anniversaries. We're coming up on the 50-year anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. Is not really about the quaint past, but the civil rights era is about how we tackle really tough problems and how citizens take responsibility for their own government, and that's basically the American creed. So in many respects, the civil rights movement is about the future, if the future is going to be defined by citizens taking charge and asking the government and petitioning the government, working through the government to resolve the issues of freedom and self-government that now plague us in this era of economic dislocation and environmental threat. So citizenship is really important, and yet we don't teach civics in school any longer. And as I said, I think our history teachers are beleaguered. So yeah. I think just as a matter of citizenship, how we teach history is important. And then there's a whole separate category of how we teach history where race relations are involved, which offers different challenges.
You took more than 2,300 pages from your trilogy about Dr. King and America during the King years and winnowed them down to 190 pages for this book, in which you take a mere 18 chapters to highlight key moments and decisions in the civil rights movement as well as the players involved. How difficult was that to do after taking, I don't know how long it took you to write the trilogy, but it took you a long time to write that, and 2,300 pages to get it down. How difficult was it to do?
It took me 24 years to write the trilogy from 1982 to 2006 when I finished. It took me really less than 2 years, about 18 months, to produce this distilled version. But the hardest part was deciding to do it because some of it is vanity. Why would I want to unwrite something that I took so much trouble and got so much pleasure out of writing?
Yeah.
And to put 95% of it on the cutting room floor wasn't easy. But I had to console myself saying that's still available for people who get involved in the issues. And what's really important is to try to show the concentrated efforts, the sweep of a transformative era in a way that will introduce that era to people who really think they know something about it or to whom it's really foreign, as something really at the heart of the American promise of what freedom is about.
And of course, if that intrigues people, they can go to the trilogy and read even more about every little thing in the book, it seems to me, and every person. But the way you wrote both of those things, the trilogy and this book, you're using this storytelling technique that makes it come alive. This is not a dull, dry trudge through history. You're telling stories, and how did you learn these stories over time?
Well, I grew up in Atlanta, segregated Atlanta, the child of a dry cleaner who was terrified of politics and scared of race relations in the segregated era. And but through my childhood, the civil rights movement was relentless all through until my senior year at Chapel Hill in the spring of my senior years when Dr. King was killed in the spring of 1968. And by that time, it had changed the direction of my life's interest because it seemed to me that issues of race went so deep in spirituality, what I thought of as equality and Christian kindness, but also in citizenship and freedom and what our relationships were. And the lesson that all those formative years gave to me, living through this era, trying, basically frightened of it, but gradually captured, is I believe that we learn about race relations when things are very personal, which goes against the grain of the way most people approach it. They try to find some sort of label about liberal or conservative or radical or militant or this, that, and the other to describe race relations. But really, that that doesn't teach us anything. The way I learned about it was when things became so human across the race lines that that it scrambled my categories, I was moved by it. That's what a movement is. We talk about movements all the time, but we seldom analyze what they are. They start when someone feels a little bit larger, or you know, an inspiration of conscience. And this is an era when movement was the watchword of politics. And it was when people were really discovering a lot of very profound things about democracy through, I believe, personal stories. And it's sad that today the watchword of politics is spin instead of movement, yeah. which basically means there isn't any movement at all, that we're cynical about politics and we use it just to, you know, have soap opera to entertain each other.
You are not an historian per se. You're a journalist who, in addition to writing these books, have also written for Harper's and Esquire and the Washington Monthly, among other publications. So is there a difference in your approach to researching and writing about all of this than one might have if you had been a pure historian?
Yes, all of that is an issue between what I call narrative historians, many of whom, like myself, are outside academics, and academic historians who tend to write what I call analytic history, which are schools of interpretation. Again, these labels about what really happened. Narrative historians, we're sensitive and defensive about the fact that some academic historians may have doubts that our material is accurate. So I, for example, source noted the trilogy overzealously, more than most people do. I have hundreds of pages of notes at the back of the books in the trilogy because I want people to know where everything I cite comes from. Mm-hmm. But when you get into the body of the text, those notes aren't in the way. The body of the text is supposed to read like a story that puts you there and that tries to identify with characters on all sides, with the FBI agents, with the Klansmen, with the young teenager deciding to risk jail in a demonstration against segregation, to the ferocious arguments over violence and nonviolence through that period, because what you learn is that the creative people on all sides during the Civil Rights Movement were perpetually in conflict with themselves. And that's something that most people tend not to be comfortable with. They want to have everything resolved so they don't have to deal with race. And what I find most enlightening about it is that it's when you go through those periods of discomfort, when you reach outside yourself, that through race relations, that really creative things have happened in American politics. And quite frankly, I think the last 50 years prove that, because dealing with race relations 50 years ago, which is a blink of an eye in historical terms, has really transformed the whole country and to some degree the whole world for the better in ways that we take for granted and don't often think about it, that it was because we dealt with race and the differences of race and the segregated era, that, for example, the white South turned into the Sun Belt of prosperity that it never was when it was segregated, that it got even professional sports teams. I bet not one person in 1,000 in the South who treasures the Carolina Panthers and the Jacksonville Jaguars realizes that before when segregation prevailed, there were no professional sports in the South. There was no Sun Belt in the South, and in that respect, and in many others, everybody today, including many who complain about the Civil Rights era, reap blessings and stand on the shoulders of it, because the White South was no longer imprisoned psychologically and economically by the burdens of segregation.
There's some other examples that you point out along those lines, which I want to get into maybe a little later on in this program. And when we come back from the break, I want to talk about how the Civil Rights Movement informs today in so many other ways, particularly with regard to American politics. Taylor Branch is our guest. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the trilogy on America in the King Years, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. His latest is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, which distills all of that down into about 190 pages. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And thanks for tuning in this morning to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and UNC Healthcare's Center for Transplant Care, providing lung transplants and treatment of respiratory diseases. More information at unclungtransplant.org. North Carolina State Treasurer Janet Cowell joins us to talk about the state's fiscal well-being and what she does to manage the finances of the state. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Sunny skies today in Charlotte, a high expected near 60 degrees tonight. Clear in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with a low around 32 degrees.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the film 12 Years a Slave is a brutal reminder of the connection between America's early economic success and the North American slave trade. Facing up to the moral and economic cost of slavery.
Join us for Diane Rehm coming up at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of America in the King Years, the trilogy, which is thousands of pages long, is our guest today. Back to talk about the King Years, historic moments in the civil rights movement. This is a shorter version of the trilogy, selections from that trilogy with introductions to each section by Taylor Branch. And it occurs to me also when the trilogy was written, we were just at the very beginnings of, maybe even before the very beginnings of electronic books and things like that. This book is meant to be a teaching tool for the digital age. There are enhancements, are there not, to the electronic edition of this book?
Yes, in many respects, this is so new, and the technology of the whole book industry is changing so rapidly that I can't really keep up with it. For example, I don't own a platform that can actually see these enhancements, so I haven't seen my own book. But for
they couldn't
those
give
who
you
have,
a Kindle.
Well, it doesn't work on Kindle, okay. So it only works on iPad and Nook, and this is something that I have a hard time keeping up with.
Right.
But for people on iPads who can access it, and even a regular ebook is new to me, that reading a book on a Kindle electronically, but a lot of people have adapted to it quite well. But this goes beyond that, and for people on iPads, if you get the enhanced ebook version and you're reading along on the text and I describe a demonstration, there'll be a little prompt and you can click and actually see news footage of the demonstration being described in the text. Or if the text talks about a very poignant conversation in which Martin Luther King is talking to President Johnson about the height of their cooperation in Selma for the Voting Rights Act, but with apprehension that their alliance is going to become frayed over the Vietnam War, which it was, you can click and literally hear them talking. You can hear the conversation that's being described in the text because President Johnson recorded his phone conversation. That's where it came from. So you can hear music. You can watch an interview with President Kennedy shortly before he's killed, talking about his fears for race relations and his fears for Vietnam, that sort of thing. So it is an illustration to help bring students who are accustomed to seeing and touching and feeling music and that sort of thing more involved in the text. So all these things are new ways of trying to make the material of history come alive for people the way it's came alive for me over in the course of all those many years studying.
Yeah, it takes you right back. I mean, if you can hear the conversation between Dr. King and President Johnson, then it takes you right into the moment that history was being made. And then when you combine it seems to me, with the prose that you've written, the stories that you tell, the way you have put this book together, it makes it, I think, more impactful, perhaps, than just watching a television documentary on the topic.
I hope so. I mean, there's another one on phone conversations, a chapter about the politics of 1964, in which the chapter describes President Johnson literally having close to a nervous breakdown because the Democratic Party, he's trying to shift it from the party of solid South segregation, which is what it had been for a century since the Civil War, into a multiracial party. And he thought he was doing it very carefully, but Southerners, moderate Southerners, said that he was going too fast and he was turning the party over to Martin Luther King. And he basically went to bed and said he was going to quit and had close to a nervous breakdown. And you can hear that in his conversation with these moderate Southern governors that I describe in the chapter. So you can hear him talking to them, the anguish in his voice. So it does make this period very dramatic and in some ways that I think most people don't appreciate.
It also helps you understand how we got to where we are today, because during the last presidential campaign, if you watched news coverage of it or listened to the pundits go on and on and on, they talked about where are the moderate Republicans, how these two political parties have shifted, and the flip really kind of began in this period, did it not? Because you point out that the basis of the Democratic and Republican parties kind of changed. There were no Republicans in Georgia, for instance, in 1964, yet they predominate there today and across the South.
Yes, they do. I took two chapters from the trilogy and put them together in this shortened book about the nominating conventions, the Republican and the Democratic in 1964, to show and make it more apparent, putting it together, what an amazing historic U-turn partisan politics took in that summer. That, as I said, the Democratic Party, which had been the solid party of segregation that I grew up with, when I grew up in Atlanta, we didn't even know any Republicans. Everybody was a Democrat. Republicans were scarce as polar bears. They were just eccentric judges who believed in a two-party system. And the black and tan, old black Party of Lincoln voters who were there for patronage jobs. Everybody was a Democrat. And the Republicans were the party of Lincoln. They were Yankees, and they had been the party of race relations. But in that one summer, 1964, President Johnson, as I said, pushed through the Civil Rights Bill, started changing the Democratic Party to one that needed to have cross-racial alliances to win elections. And the Republicans went in a sharp U-turn in the opposite direction when Barry Goldwater, their presidential candidate, announced that he was going to vote against the Civil Rights Act as a usurpation of states' rights and an overreaching power grab by the federal government. Instantly, Southern Republicans sprang up as converts. They basically lifelong Democrats ran down to the courthouse to switch party registration and begin running. There was not a single member of the House of Representatives who was a Republican between the Atlantic Ocean and the far reaches of Texas in 1964. But now, after that U-turn, it's largely reversed. And what I hope people will learn from that is that race had the power to turn the partisan structure of American politics upside down. And at the same time this happened, nobody recognized it was happening. It's something that we're largely unconscious of. So it is a very, very strong subliminal force in politics that we pretend it's not there.
So when we have red states, blue states today, and the red states are predominantly in the heartland of America, the conservative heartland, and then the South, does that stem from this switch?
Yes, we are largely living with the consequences of a partisan transition that was driven plainly on its face by race. I mean, I argue there, it's only 50 years ago, in January, that George Wallace took office in Alabama as governor, pledging segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And the whole South was segregated. It was in the constitutions of the Southern states. It was segregated by race. Women couldn't go to Chapel Hill, where I went, unless they were nursing students. They were only in body. So it was segregated by gender and stratified in ways that really people will have a hard time remembering. He failed to protect that segregation, but when Wallace retreated, he invented a lot of the language of modern politics. He, when he couldn't, it was no longer respectable for him to defend segregation. He made it respectable to cuss the federal government. He called them pointy-headed bureaucrats in Washington telling us how to run our business and where we should go to school and who we should be friends with, and that they were in league with in cahoots with a biased media.
You know, these are the same arguments that are being posited by people today on different topics. Do they stem from this? Is there a racial undercurrent to all of this that's happening today? This is beyond the scope of your book, I know, but these arguments are the same.
Yes. The language of resenting the federal government, which to some degree the Republican Party is now finding as kind of a dead end, is an attitude and resentment, was largely invented in this period, and it came to dominate politics. I think the dominant idea in politics, it's fair to say, for the last 50 years is that the government is bad, at least when directed against these, in the aims of the civil rights era. But in fact, if you look at it, empirically, this is plain wrong. Nobody really wants to undo these things. Nobody wants to resegregate. Nobody wants to kick women out of the University of North Carolina the way it used to be, or even out of West Point. Nobody wants to undo the Americans for Disability Act, the improvements for senior citizens that we have. The word gay wasn't even invented in 1963, and it was beyond the pale. That you would have the kind of protections. It was all criminalized. And now we have things that where conservatives are coming around to accommodate civil unions, and we're always but are frightened by the final step, which is maybe marriage rights. So in many respects, we value and the achievements of this era, but we cuss the process because we're still kind of imprisoned in this notion that all of this was bad. But by our behavior and our values, we show that it wasn't.
Yeah, it's the marketing has been virtuosic. Is that right? Is that a word?
Virtuoso marketing. Yes.
of the opinion that government is bad, and as a result, it has created this dislike for national government. You point out, as you just said, but I'm going to say it word for word here from something I read from you, that people who resent politics and Washington have a warped memory of the movement. You say that if you are a white Southerner and you're happy that your daughter can go to West Point, it's because of the changes that started coming out in the 1960s. And it actually begins, you point out, before the 1964 election, because you point out in the 1960 election, the presidential campaign between Richard Nixon, the vice president, Republican vice president, and the Democrat John Kennedy, Dr. King had gotten arrested for the third time, this time at Rich's Department Store, which is a very nice department store in Atlanta, during a sit-in. Republican candidate and Vice President Richard Nixon made mention of the GOP's historic relationship with the emancipator Abraham Lincoln. But Democrat John Kennedy phoned Coretta Scott King, and that is said to have helped swing the election in his direction. How so?
Yes, Martin Luther King became known as the Negro, which was the word in those years, the Negro that elected a president, because a personal call of, again, race relations is about things that are personal. He dared to call Coretta King and just express personal sympathy, and word of that was spread like wildfire among by black preachers in churches, and the Kennedy administration secretly put out a pamphlet saying that Kennedy was the candidate with a heart. They didn't want to do this in public because they were afraid they would alienate white voters. Mm-hmm. But the cultures were so separate that they spread the word among black voters all across the North in churches, that Kennedy had expressed sympathy. And, you know, black voters had traditionally voted Republican, and they switched and put a Democrat in office. And so, yes, these subtle little things across the party lines changed politics and began elevating Martin Luther King in stature just for going to jail in 1960.
We have an email from Larry who says, I wonder what Mr. Branch thinks of this notion of mine, that the progenitor of the modern civil rights movement is Branch Rickey. Mr. Rickey, in late 1945, hired Jackie Robinson, who in April 1947 became the first Negro in the major leagues, and the world changed.
Yes, I think the world changed. It certainly to be a fan and know the history of Branch Rickey helps people understand, of course, that the race issue was not never has been and still isn't purely sectional, because that was about segregation in major league sports that didn't exist in the South. There were no Southern baseball teams, in part because of segregation. When I grew up in Atlanta, our team was the Atlanta Crackers in the Southern Association. People always laugh at that team, and the Negro League team was the Atlanta Black Crackers because we didn't have major league sports down there. Everybody was either a St. Louis Cardinals fan or a New York Yankees fan.
Explain that. Why is that? Was it because – you said it's because of segregation, but it was a segregated nation. So why did it matter in the South that we were segregated?
Well, in the North, just the subtleties. The teams were segregated, which made Branch. The players were segregated. There weren't any black players until Jackie Robinson. That's what made him a pioneer in 1947, the year I was born. But the stands were not. You could go, and therefore there were no conflicts. And if you were managing a major league baseball team, you didn't have to worry about a conflict that your segregation policy might keep an African diplomat out and cause an international incident. Mm. There were all kind of headaches about what would and wouldn't happen if you enforced segregation rules that you didn't have to worry about on the fans. You didn't have to worry about in the North. You did in the South, and therefore it wasn't worth the headache. You didn't have Southern teams. My mayor, Ivan Allen in Atlanta, said famously that as soon as the Civil Rights Bill was passed in 1964, the city of Atlanta built a stadium on land it didn't own with money it didn't have for a team it hadn't located, but very quickly persuaded the Milwaukee Braves to move to Atlanta, become the Atlanta Braves, and begin professional sports in the South because they didn't have to worry about all these issues of segregation that had crippled not only the sports world, but in some senses the corporate economy of the South. And so that was a wonderful change that grew out of that era.
The civil rights movement of the early 60s and mid-60s coincided with something else that was changing in America, and that's television news. It was 1964, I think, that marked the beginning of network television news as we know it, with Walter Cronkite on CBS and Chet Huntley and David Brinkley on NBC. And they expanded their newscasts, I think, from 15 minutes to 30 minutes, which they remain at today, which is a disgrace. It was also the beginning of pointing fingers at the media for having an agenda. Talk about that.
Yes, the television news, which was just coming into its own as a national and cultural force. I mean, when you think about the Kennedy assassination, the average family over that weekend watched 30 hours of television. It was a bonding experience watching the Kennedy assassination. And news images were very, very powerful. But, of course, that was exactly the time when there were news images of dogs and fire hoses being loosed on young black marchers in Birmingham, many of them girls as young as 8 years old, and it had tremendous effect that the new era of television was also the era in which you showed photographs that were uncomfortable of issues that people really wanted to avoid, but it mobilized citizens.
And it came into your living room. People who were not alive then don't realize that people, when they got an opportunity to see the news, it was either in Life or Look magazine or at newsreels at the movie theaters before television news. I want to come back to this and talk more about it in the next segment. Taylor Branch is our guest. The King Years, Historic Movements in the Civil Rights Movement, is his condensation of his award-winning, Pulitzer Prize award-winning trilogy about the King Years. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio. Where support this morning comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. Introducing the Heartwood Landscape Watchdog, a year-round monitoring program to discover and protect trees and landscape plants from insects and disease. Info available at 704-525-3066. The film 12 Years a Slave is a brutal reminder of the connection between America's early economic success and the North American slave trade. Facing up to the moral and economic cost of slavery, that story on The Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 o'clock.
We come into your home every Saturday morning, and we try to be the kind of guest that you look forward to. So, we bring you the latest news, conversations with thinkers, writers, singers, comics, economists, public figures, and everyday citizens. And we won't open your refrigerator to see what's inside. I'm Scott Simon. Please join us this weekend on NPR News.
Hear the latest news with Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday from 8 till 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, Taylor Branch, our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of America in the King Years. Now the King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, a distillation of that Pulitzer Prize-winning trilogy. We were talking about television before the break and the birth of television news as we know it today with the Huntley-Brinkley Report on NBC and Walter Cronkite on CBS. And then you reference at some point NBC's Frank McGee and a three-hour special on race that NBC did back then that went on the air for 3 hours with no commercial interruptions because they couldn't sell it. There comes a time, he said in that documentary, that there even comes a moment in the affairs of men when they sense that their lives are being altered forever. We are experiencing a revolution. And I believe you say that that caused a stir, that statement.
It did cause a stir because he was expressly addressing the realization that there was a crisis over race relations and the principles of democracy that the civil rights movement was relentlessly putting in front of people. And just to acknowledge that openly upset a lot of people. Most people did not want to talk about race relations, and so they blamed the media, even though this was it was a mixture of being very bold because devoting 3 hours of network television to race relations that made people uncomfortable was very bold. And yet at the same time, they knew that their southern stations weren't going to like it. So they didn't have any concept. They didn't have any argument there. In fact, to avoid it, they put things in alphabetical order and was involved. And they just showed news footage and people arguing about race relations. I think they started in Amherst. And went alphabetically through because they didn't want to hazard any interpretive structure, but it was about race. And Frank McGee, who had come from Montgomery, Alabama, said some frank things that were shocking in that time. He said he had just started his career during the Montgomery bus boycott, and he said, "We weren't a bad people, the white folks of Montgomery, but we just didn't understand that black people demanding equal treatment couldn't be dismissed like teenagers asking to stay out after 8 o'clock at night." There was a kind of a naive quality across the racial lines that were shown in this show, but a lot of people were upset about it, and George Wallace and many others denounced the news media for mm-hmm. overemphasizing the race issue.
Were they right? I mean, it seems to me the argument could be made that when a national television network produces a three-hour documentary and then finds that it cannot sell commercials in it because the commercial advertisers are worried about the content of it, but they go ahead and put it on the air anyway, that could be interpreted as the network having an agenda. It could also be interpreted or argued that the network is simply reporting the news, which is true.
Yes, they're both true, that people are overwrought about it, that race underlies an awful lot of the fundamental issues in American politics. Listen, if you look back at it, the 14th and 15th Amendment, all due process, all of the politics of due process came from the 14th and 15th Amendments, which were about how to treat slaves after the Civil War. Much of the constitutional issues have to do with slavery. There's been an unspoken racial context in most of our politics. And what I would argue from the civil rights period, in any way, is that while it is the racial issues are fraught, they are also the doorway to great progress, because when you deal explicitly about things that make people uncomfortable, like segregation, it let loose a lot of progress, not only for black people who were no longer segregated, and unimaginable things like a black president became possible, but it liberated white people and women and senior citizens in ways. So dealing with race openly is the doorway to progress, because it is the unspoken issue about, you know, how true we are to our democratic ideals.
It also seems to me that people could not possibly, in many cases, not all, have fully understood the plight of the African American citizen, even under segregation and Jim Crow, because we were, as you said, completely separate societies. We didn't see the conditions they lived in. We didn't see the oppressive nature of the police force against people in Selma or Montgomery or wherever in the Deep South. We didn't see it until television came along and showed it to us and put those pictures in our living room night after night after night. And just as television, I think, changed the course of the Vietnam War, it must have hastened the end of this kind of society and the beginnings of civil rights, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And television was very important. And, of course, the civil rights movement within it, inside the civil rights movement, where all those arguments were taking place, they consciously understood that part of their task was to make visible things that most people did not want to see. And so they had to struggle to figure out through demonstrations. That's what sit-ins were about. That's what the Freedom Rides were about. That's what the March on Washington was about. It was about making visible a largely invisible culture. I mean, the newspapers in the South refused to use courtesy titles, black people were not in the news. When they were, you would never say Dr. King, you would say the King Man or the Parks Woman. The stories about Rosa Parks, she was not Mrs. Rosa Parks, she was the Parks Woman, because the culture was so strong that it did not want to recognize anything on the other side of the racial line as a part of legitimate culture and news.
And that is where Dr. King's philosophy of nonviolent protest turned out to be truly brilliant, because when you are looking at pictures of police with attack dogs and water hoses and batons beating people to a pulp, and they're not resisting and they're not causing problems and they're not breaking windows and robbing stores, they're just walking down the street, it shakes something inside, I think, even the most hardened person.
Yes, nonviolence was the central idea and the most powerful idea of the civil rights era, both for the black people involved in nonviolence and for the white people involved. In many respects, it goes to the heart of defining what democracy is. Dr. King always used to say, if you believe in democracy, you believe in nonviolence, whether you know it or not, because democracy is a system of votes, and a vote is nothing but a piece of nonviolence. So it was a powerful idea. It was also the first idea to become unpopular, because it took a toll on people. It doesn't come naturally. A lot of people say, well, America really believes in nonviolence only for black people, and otherwise we admire John Wayne and James Bond and Bruce Willis in the movies, that we love of violence. So in some respects, civil rights supporters are themselves helped us turn away from the lessons of this period, help us get imprisoned by the notion that it was not the blessing that it was, because they turned away from nonviolence. Many also turned away from the spiritual roots, conceding spirituality and religion to the opponents of civil rights, what we call today the religious right, when in fact the civil rights movement drew heavily. The most distinctive thing about Dr. King was that he would put one foot in the scriptures and the other in the Constitution in a very balanced way, and many of his followers have kind of forgotten that spiritual base.
So this book, the new distillation of your trilogy, The King Years, Historic Movements, and the Civil Rights Movement, you've chosen 18 moments within that vast expanse of time. And you begin with an event that centers around the woman who just had her 100th birthday, Rosa Parks. You begin with the Montgomery bus boycott. This is the moment that seems to have kick-started the movement into high gear. And also, it's the moment in history when Martin Luther King first became a public person and gradually a national figure. What made that happen for him with regard to the Montgomery bus boycott? Why that event?
Well, he was chosen as a young, he was only 26 and he was new to Montgomery. And when Rosa Parks was arrested and a spontaneous boycott broke out, largely caused by the women of Montgomery, the black women of Montgomery called to stay off the buses for a day on Monday, the day of her trial. And when it happened, the ministers got together and drafted Dr. King to explain what they were doing at a mass meeting of all black Montgomery. And I dropped people into this first chapter with him going home to tell Coretta that he can't have dinner because he has to go give a speech about what this bus boycott means. And he normally takes 15 hours to prepare a sermon. He's got 20 minutes. He doesn't have time to eat. And he shows up thinking about what he's going to say. And instead of a couple of hundred people there, there were 5,000 outside the church. And he said it could be, this could turn into something big, what's going to happen. And I try to take people through that speech because he's a PhD, very erudite person, speaking to a working class crowd of mostly maids and sharecroppers about what the bus boycott means. And most of them are strangers to him. And you can hear in the speech him kind of groping around for what it means. And then all of a sudden in the give and take of black church rhetoric, he strikes a chord. He says there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. And he goes on to the next sentence, but then a wave of applause comes back. And for the whole rest of the speech, you can really feel a communion growing between him and the audience, which is the beginnings of a movement. It made him forever a public person. He was only 26 years old. He had only about a dozen more years to live through this extraordinary period of the civil rights movement until his death in 1968. But in one sense, movement begins with communion with an audience, and this is the birth of Dr. King as a public person and really the birth of the modern civil rights movement on that one night when they tried to make sense of what had happened to Rosa Parks.
So you begin with Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. Why there? Because the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision that struck down school desegregation predated the bus boycott. Emmett Till's murder when he was a 14-year-old boy, that predated the bus boycott. Why begin with Rosa Parks?
Well, first of all, for my storytelling rules that I'm trying to tell stories by a Supreme Court decision is hard to dramatize. I do mention that those are the kinds of things that I include in the introductions. But I try to go historic moments. Mm-hmm. The bus boycott and Rosa Parks and Dr. King explaining it is a moment that is very dramatic, and you can feel it happen, and it's personal. And so it was the founding of a movement that was drawing on and informed by these other historic events like the Brown decision and the Emmett Till case, which were kind of bookends of the era. You had the court saying that race segregation is incompatible with American principles, and then you have the Emmett Till case, basically, in which somebody is murdered. Emmett Till is murdered for nothing and to enforce the racial caste system and acquitted by a jury, and his killers are almost proud of it. And it really showed people that despite the arid pronouncements about what was American in law, that there was a caste reality that was brutal and existed right alongside of it. So what are you going to make of that? And the bus boycott comes along right after it to try to say, okay, well, we're going to try to reconcile these things. We're going to face the fact that there are grim realities behind our our pretense about democracy, and we're going to try to deal with it. And that's what began with Dr. King, and he did that until all the way when he was killed in Memphis, through the upheavals over Birmingham, over the March on Washington, Selma, the voting rights, his conflicts with J. Edgar Hoover, the Vietnam War, and all of the great episodes of the movement to follow.
You go from the Montgomery bus boycott to the sit-in movement that gained traction with the sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina. What was different about that sit-in that gave that kicked that up a notch?
Well, first of all, it was whereas the bus boycott was a lot of older adults who walked for a year to stay off the buses, the sit-ins was college students. The first news about the sit-ins dismissed them as panty raids because people couldn't really assimilate the idea that college students were serious actors in a political drama. Dr. King was the exception. He was the only adult civil rights leader. He wasn't that much older than these students. But he said it was a breakthrough because they had figured out a way to make witness against segregation in a way that dramatized things. Whereas he had been trying to preach America out of segregation, he was an orator, and he had learned a hard lesson that there are some things in human nature that are so stubborn that words aren't enough, and you need to amplify them with witness. And he praised the students for figuring out a way to do it. It spread. There had been sit-ins for a long time. I was struggling with this in my class. I'm teaching a class based on this just last night. And one of the things the student said was that the first sit-in, in a way, may have spread like wildfire. There had been others because they did it spontaneously. They didn't have a plan, the four sit-in students in Greensboro. And at the end of the—and what they learned was that the white people, they let them sit there all day. They didn't want to arrest them. They didn't want to call the police, but they couldn't serve them either. So what the students learned was that white people had misgivings about whether this was fair, too, and they didn't know what to do. And at the end of the day, they said, "We'll be back tomorrow." So, in effect, it created a drama of surprise that everybody had always thought segregation was open and shut. And at the end of this day of the first sit-ins, these students recruited lots of others. So it spread like wildfire. Beginning, again, is a movement.
We have just scratched the surface of this, obviously, with this conversation. His book, Taylor Branch's book, The King Years, Historic Movements, Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, takes a deeper scratch at it because it just skims the surface of his magnificent trilogy on the topic. But I thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7.